And the best pathway, I think, to get black and brown folks jobs is to have black and brown folks owning businesses that are then hiring people in their community. And I think that's the reality of human beings, is we're very tribal by nature. And we hire who's in our network. And oftentimes, with our white counterparts, they don't have a lot of people of color in their network. They're not sitting down to dinner at their house with people of color. And so it's, you know, they don't come to the conclusion of, oh man, there's, you know, 80,000 black people in Portland and I don't have one of them working at my place. Like I gotta do something about that. I gotta, you know, make an inroads and build trust in community. People aren't thinking about that.
Welcome into Priced Out, the podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Morgan, alongside Cornelius Swart. How you doing today, man?
I am good. I am glad to be here, sir.
Got a great show for him today. I'm really excited about this one because we don't get many African-American guests. So I'm always really excited. I'm messing with you, man.
It's a podcast. People can't see. Yeah, so this is Stephen Green, who Stephen is in Priced Out, the documentary, and I've been talking with Stephen about these issues for 5 years or about. And when I started doing Priced Out, Stephen actually approached me and he's like, you know, I love the first film and I'd love to talk to you. And Stephen comes from an entrepreneurial background. He has a tremendous perspective that is he's so brilliant and nuanced. But he's only in the film for literally like a minute, maybe. And so he's part of this group of people that we felt we couldn't include in the film, but we've been covering in the podcast because their perspective is so valuable in getting a real sense of what's going on. And so he's coming in with the entrepreneurial and business-focused perspective, which really is hinted at with people like Tony Hobson and John Washington and Fred Stewart. You see a hint of this entrepreneurial point of view of gentrification, but we're really very lucky to have Stephen to talk with at length about this.
All right, let's get into it.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I'm calling this podcast Everything Cornelius Says Is Wrong.
Wow.
And, you know, we have spoken on panel discussions several times, and you're always bringing in stuff that, you know, we've left out of the film. You're in the film just briefly, and we have a whole series of these podcasts called Cut Out or Left Out, which is just stuff that we couldn't get in there. So what are we missing? In just a quick summary, what is Priced Out, what is the larger media conversation missing in the story of gentrification, in your view?
Yeah, I think the story of change as it relates to North Northeast Portland is a story about, you know, not only Nikki's story and the trauma that goes along with that, but also the number of other perspectives and realities at a macro level that existed at the very same time that, you know, she was going through the plight of what was happening in the 1990s. During the 90s, you had approximately 80% of the state's black population living in two zip codes, 97211 and 97212. And one of the things that, you know, was a reality with that was that, you know, black families couldn't choose to live where they wanted to live. And so if somebody got a job at Intel, they'd have issues being able to purchase a house and get a realtor to return their phone call. Discriminatory housing practices, you know, haven't ended completely, but definitely got a lot easier during the 90s. And the 90s was when we saw the biggest appreciation of homes in inner North Northeast Portland. And so I'll use the example of my home in Woodlawn. My home in Woodlawn sold in 1990 for $7,000. In 1998, it sold for $98,000.
And that's kind of the typical gentrification, you know, story. Is that story? So what are we missing?
What we're missing is some of the people wanted to leave there. By and large, people in the Black community didn't have the option. They didn't, you know, we didn't come together and say, hey, Northeast Portland is where we want to live. There was the Vanport flood. And you know, the original Black community was where we're sitting right now in the Pearl in Old Town. The first Black businesses, Mount Olivet Baptist Church, the oldest Black church.
Yeah, and we were just talking about that, that it was around the railroad station.
Here. Yeah. Yeah, and so the railroad station and the building of Portland Hotel was originally what brought Blacks from around the country to the city of Portland.
And what you talk about in the film is at the end you say it's less important, I'm paraphrasing, about where folks are and more about how they're doing wherever they are.
Yes. So to me, I think part of you know, what gets lost in this conversation around people being either involuntarily or voluntarily displaced from geographic locations is, you know, how are they doing as a family unit? How are they doing as a household? What does the wealth look like for that community as they change geographies? And unfortunately, the wealth gap is widening more and more and more. And so I think what gets lost when we think about, you know, everything's going to be solved if Black people can move back to Northeast Portland, or, you know, now that they're gone and they're not all isolated there, things are better, is we lose focus on the data points that really speak to how a community is doing. And if we're not talking about educational attainment, wealth, and wage levels, then we've kind of lost the mark of what I think is really important when you're looking at, you know, how a community's doing.
And I think there's two points on that you often speak about when we do panels, and that is sort of community, like geographic community versus a community of by association or a social network community, in which you talk about that in the film, that your community is an intentional community of peers, and that you go to events where there are Black judges, Black attorneys, Black CEOs, and that's your peer group community.
Yeah.
And then you don't get that sense of community from a neighborhood, right? And then the other point is, and to that point, you usually like to emphasize that there are more Black folks in the Portland metro area now than ever before.
Right.
And then the second point is the point you just made, which is a wealth creation. There's right. not enough talk about what is going on with wealth creation in the African-American community, and what do we need to do as a society to create parity so that African-American folks have the same opportunities to create wealth, rather than sort of a social justice or public service driven conversation.
Right. And I think you really need both. And so, you know, this is where perspective is so important, right? So as someone whose parents bought a house in Alloa back in the 70s.
Which is a suburb in the far west
yes,
of Portland. 15
miles west of Portland.
Which is far for Portland.
Yeah. And, you know, when growing up there with my brothers, I've only lived there in Detroit, Michigan. And, you know, if we saw a Black person at a grocery store or church or at school, they were instant family.
Right.
And there,
right,
was a,
right.
there was a connection and a bond
right.
That developed. So I have a number of aunts and uncles and cousins who are not blood related at all. And it was all because of the shared experience. And so the perspective that I see that when I go and visit my parents over there in Alloa is I see more Black people. Mount Olivet Baptist Church mm-hmm. has, you know, a location out in Alloa, which
right.
is wild for me to even comprehend.
And they're pretty much the oldest Black congregation in Portland and Oregon.
In the state of Oregon, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so one perspective is I see more people of color in the area of the region where I grew up, right? Mm-hmm. And the flip side of that is in my neighborhood in Woodlawn, some of my neighbors have only ever lived in Woodlawn, in that neighborhood. And so for them to see their neighborhood or their street go from 100% Black or 80% Black to 20% Black, they astutely come to the conclusion, well, there's a lot less Black people in Portland.
Right.
Right. right? Mm-hmm. And so me giving them a data set doesn't change their perspective.
Right.
And so I think what's been lost there is that there's a sense of community. And I would have loved to have had more Black and Latino neighbors growing up, but I didn't have that out there. And so the dispersion of people leads to this changing of perspectives depending on where you were living at the time.
Yeah, you moved from the suburbs back into Woodlawn, which was traditionally a black neighborhood since post-war era. So you made a reverse commute, so to speak. Do you consider yourself a gentrifier?
Yeah, I mean, by definition, I'm someone who owns property. So the definition of a gentrifier is a gentry, someone who owns property and is coming in. Mm. And so by definition, I would be considered a gentrifier.
And then you said before that you have a neighbor, Chico.
Chico.
Who lives next to you, and he's never crossed a bridge, or at least up until some point he had never crossed a bridge.
So I remember when we moved into our house, Chico's family used to own the house that we lived in, and he said, I was born in that house. And I was like, oh, your mom went into labor in the house? And he's like, no, I was born in the house. And he went on to tell me how his family owned four houses right there on the street, and he was 18 before he crossed a bridge.
Wow.
And
this is Portland. You can't like swing a dead cat without hitting a bridge in Portland.
Yeah, exactly. And so, to him, that neighborhood was Portland.
Right.
And
everything.
Portland was that neighborhood. And so I think when I hear Nikki's story, that's what really resonates with me, is that Portland was her neighborhood. And so the trauma that she feels is wrapped around Portland, even if it was, part of a smaller geographic area.
Tell us a little bit about your world. We know you grew up in the western suburbs. Mm-hmm. What's your career path? I know what you do, but can you tell folks sort of what you have been doing career-wise and kind of some of your activist activities as well?
Yeah. So, born in the Bay, went to school growing up as a kid on the west side of town, and then every summer I would live in East Detroit. So did that from when I was 6 to 18. My dad's from East Detroit. And so I got this perspective of seeing both ends of the spectrum, So in Alloa, I wouldn't see any other black people. And in East Detroit, I wouldn't see any white people at all. And I knew, my dad would tell me the real world is somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. But if you can function in East Detroit and you can function in Alloa, then the rest of the world, you'll be able to function. And so, always been interested in entrepreneurship, numbers, always been in finance and working with startups and entrepreneurs throughout my business career.
Your degree is in economics?
Economics. I've just always been fascinated about being a problem solver for people that, have these passionate dreams that they want to accomplish. And me and my spreadsheets can kind of help them along the way figure out the difference between a hobby and a business and how they can make money along the way.
And you've worked at the city of Portland?
Yeah, I worked at the city of Portland for what was then PDC, Portland Development Commission.
In the film.
Yeah. I was there for 7 years working on real estate development, mainly in North and Northeast Portland and supporting founders of color. And so got to do some amazing work helping local property owners, long-term property owners of color mainly, develop their properties and their businesses so that they could stay and benefit from the changes that were happening over time.
So as someone who was inside PDC at the time when the gentrification was, rolling through, a lot of people are going to say PDC intentionally displaced the black community. They intentionally gentrified the community.
Yeah.
We like to unpack the term here, but what is your response to those people who surely have said that to you many, many times?
I guess my path working there was always one of, fighting the good fight from the inside. And there was a number of other African-American and non-African-American folks that I would consider part of that fighting the good fight from the inside as well. But we all function inside of structures, right? And so one of the things that I think we weren't able to deal with, and still the city hasn't come to deal with, is the trauma that's happened, right? Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people that grew up in inner North Northeast, they have stories or their family has stories, and there's never been a reckoning of, PDC or the city going and saying, hey, let's have a conversation about this because there's been trauma. It's done. What can we do to start rebuilding trust? And I think that starts with having those conversations. And so you can't program your way out of that. You can't write checks out of that. And so you've got to go and kind of call a timeout, like Meyer Memorial Trust did a few years ago when they were looking to have an equity lens in their work, and they literally called a timeout and didn't do anything for a year where they really, really worked on what that that lens was going to be.
Being inside, though, do you feel, did you see an attitude of, we need to get these people out of this neighborhood?
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, no, I think what I always saw was people that were really, really committed to community mm-hmm. and oftentimes didn't understand the externalities.
Understand the impact of what they were doing.
Of things that would happen that sometimes was what they were doing. Sometimes it was what was happening at a state level. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was what was happening at a city council level. So.
So I want to take the conversation back just a little bit. For me, I moved here and I took an entrepreneurial path, and my wife opened up a beauty shop. And so we see African Americans in large numbers because we said, okay, we're going to go out and do natural hair.
Right.
And so in the community in which we see it, but in large, it still has a feel sometimes as though it's not a lot of black people here. And we were told ahead of time that there are not a lot of black people. How does that, how do we stop that myth from kind of circulating?
So I guess the way I always separate this is thinking about what the number of black people is here and whether there's a lot or a little versus can I have a black experience while I'm here in Portland? And for me, regardless of how many black people there are here in the city, I have a very rich black and Latino experience. Like on a daily basis, I'm at black businesses. I'm at, you know, community organizations. I serve on boards for black oriented nonprofits. And so regardless of the number, I have a very rich black experience. Tonight, there's going to be a gathering of 60 black men at a local black owned business that we do quarterly. And you know, yes, maybe in our jobs or on our street, we don't see ourselves a lot, but we can always choose to you know, go to your wife's shop or do these other things where we do, you know, come in regular contact with black people.
So it takes an effort, basically. It's not going to be a community that's just given to you. So with that, how did you manage to network? Because here's one of the problems I ran across, and it was surely just on me to some extent, but there's a myth that kind of goes around all black communities that is difficult to get us together, that some, like, people won't support your event or people won't do this. And so sometimes you go into it with a defeated attitude.
Right.
Have you ever experienced that?
I always come from the same standpoint of abundance. And I put on a number of events, entrepreneurial and otherwise. But I start from the standpoint of, I know they exist. How can I find different ways to bring people together and remove barriers? Right. And I have I know other folks that will put on events and they have an idea in their mind of number of people that'll show up or the kind of people that'll show up. And then they get whoever they get and then they're defeated, as opposed to going that extra step and thinking about, oh, well, I had this hypothesis. Here's who came. Here's what I can work on the next time. You know, the event I'm putting on tonight, like, there'll probably be 50 people there, but sometimes there's six. And I'm fine with that. And we have an amazing, rich conversation about what's going on. But for me, you know, I try and attack it from a standpoint of an abundance. I think one of the things that I see often and that I think is difficult is this idea of a difference between people who are local black folks and folks who have come here from other places.
I was just about to ask you about that.
Yeah. And you know, I think for some folks, they're gonna, you know, unless you went to Jefferson High School and were on a specific street, you're not from here. And where I come from is, like, you know, I grew up, my dad and my mom always told me, you see somebody who's black or brown, you give them a nod. That's your community, no matter where you're at, right? And so for me, if you're down for the cause, I don't care if you've been here 30 years or 30 minutes. Like, you're living a shared experience here in this town. regardless of how long you've been here. And so I pushed through that, but there's always going to be detractors. I remember when I started my event, Pitch Black, where we support black founders, there was people in the community that were like, oh, you didn't get so-and-so to sign off on this, and, you know, so-and-so didn't know about you doing this. And I was like, so? Like, they can, you know, we can have more than one black event, and, you know, like, I don't feel bad. Happy to take any feedback on how I can change things, but, you know, we had 300 people come, and, you know, these businesses are doing pretty well. Like, I'm kind of all right with it.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
So how is the black entrepreneurial community doing? It's something that we don't talk about in the field. Yeah. It's something you're an economist, you work for the city, and you're on a lot of sort of different housing boards that look after affordable housing, but also, tell us about your entrepreneurial stuff and how things are going.
Yeah. So I think for black entrepreneurs, we've doubled in number. So we've got over 5,000 black entrepreneurs that exist in Oregon. But when you go and you look at the data that does exist, and there's not a lot of data that exists around particularly access to capital. Recently, the Portland Business Journal did an article after doing some digging into the numbers of SBA loans, and they saw that in the past 10 years, the number of loans to black businesses in the state of Oregon has dropped 96%.
Wow.
96%. And at the very same time, the number of black businesses in the state has more than doubled.
Huh.
Right. So it's not a, you know, they're disappearing and they're just not opening. No, they're, you know, coming and starting businesses more than ever, but they're not tapping into traditional forms of funding. And so to me, that begs a number of other questions.
Kickstarter's just off the hook.
So, yeah, are they, you know, like, for example, with with both my business as well as my wife's, we didn't really need to get a loan.
Yep.
It was, okay, we have enough money saved right now. Yep. Let's buy what we need. Let's go.
Yep.
Same thing with starting a media company. It was, all right, let me get some of the base equipment and let me not pick up this debt. That was kind of my attitude toward it. Do you think that maybe that's the attitude that a lot of African Americans are having?
That's what most businesses do, black, white, or otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like 80% of businesses, they self-fund, mm-hmm. right? And so that there's no difference there in the way a black founder starts a business than a white founder. Where the difference lies is what does that wealth look like, right? And so in the United States, African-American households approximately have about $7,000 in wealth, right? When you take their liabilities versus their assets, that's what they're worth. And so it's very hard to start a business when that's what the numbers are and you don't have these multiple generations of wealth that you're building on top of. Mm-hmm. So what you described is very common for most businesses to do. Where it becomes an issue is when you look to scale. Right. So your wife's killing it with her business and she says, hey, I want to do one in Salem. I want to do one in Medford. It's very hard to fund expansion without taking on some sort mm-hmm. of debt. And so businesses get started, but they don't scale. And I think they don't scale for a number of reasons. One is access to capital is generally limited, particularly inside friends and family. Right. The other piece is oftentimes, you know, where we as a community aren't championing our businesses to grow and scale, right? Mm-hmm. Like they think, oh, I'm doing all right in Northeast Portland, or I'm doing all right downtown, as opposed to, man, you could kill it in Oakland, you could kill it in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Why don't you do a location in Tokyo? And there's no one generally pushing them to do that, and there's not organizations that are going and saying, hey, I was showing someone your brand in Bogota, Colombia, we should start selling stuff there. Right.
So is that a cultural thing or is there something that, you know, we should be looking at in terms of policy here at the city or at state, federal level?
I don't think it's a cultural thing. I think we don't have a number of organizations here that exist to really spur on the scaling of businesses owned by people of color. Mm-hmm. If you look at a lot of the organizations that are facing towards people of color, they help people with micro loans or micro businesses, but they're you know, oftentimes not engaged in conversations of how do you sell and other countries, or how do we, you know, go and scale this thing up to being a multi-million dollar business?
And how does like wealth creation, which you've talked a lot about in the past, how does that feed in, intersect or not, with the ongoing, more traditional social justice narrative about inequality and inequality of treatment in the Black community by mainstream society?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the biggest enemy of you getting in trouble or getting off the beaten track is a job, right? And the best pathway, I think, to get Black and brown folks jobs is to have Black and brown folks owning businesses that are then hiring people in their community. And I think that's the reality of human beings, is we're very tribal by nature. And we hire who's in our network. And oftentimes, with our white counterparts, they don't have a lot of people of color in their network. They're not sitting down to dinner at their house with people of color. And so it's, they don't come to the conclusion of, oh, man, there's, 80,000 Black people in Portland, and I don't have one of them working at my place. Like, I gotta do something about that. I gotta, make an inroads and build trust in community. People aren't thinking about that. So when it comes to social justice stuff, hey, if you want to, see kids do better in school and do all these things, like show great examples of people that look like them doing a diverse array of stuff. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, someone who's only ever lived here, they've never seen a Black mayor in Portland, right? And I think for kids, it can't be what you don't see.
Until you said that, I never realized I had the benefit of growing up with Emmanuel Cleaver as my mayor the bulk of my life. So, that's something else.
And what you've said it in the past is that a lot of these Black businesses, you're talking about the proliferation of Black businesses, they're not retail businesses. They can be industrial businesses. A drone manufacturer, you were just talking about, who's the drone?
Airship Technologies Group, Ben Berry.
There you go.
Great guy, born and raised here.
And the winery.
Yeah, Pertoni Fossen, I think one of the things that we don't talk about when we're talking about, historic Black communities, and one of the things that people miss about the Vancouver Williamses of the world is that back then the white business owners weren't going to serve the Black community, and vice versa. A Black business owner couldn't go and just pop up in Beaverton or downtown and be where there was more opportunity to make money. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, the Black folks had to create service businesses and the all the things that you use in daily existence. And that had to be done by other Black folks. And so that would lead to this community that you get to see and talk to every day. And now you don't get to see that unless you're proactive about it. Right.
Right.
And so it's easy to go and say, well, that doesn't exist now, because it existed in a small geography before, but it's gone away.
And in some ways, the tables have turned in that a lot of times you had Black people in the front of the shop in the neighborhood, but those were actually white-owned businesses. True. And now you have a reverse where there's white people in the front of the shop, but it's a Black-owned business. And could you tell us a story about, you're involved with the Oregon Public House, which is, it's a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And you're one of the owners of that nonprofit, but people
don't
know that.
Like, yeah, they're gonna walk in and say, it's a Black-owned business. I'm one of the founders of that. And since it's a not-for-profit, we don't technically have people owners, but one of the original folks. And it's always fascinating. People assign different industries to different communities.
Right.
And so I think historically people would never say Black people do wine or Black people do beer. But in reality, the number one brewer in the country is a Black guy at Brooklyn Brewing named Garrett Oliver, who won the James Beard Award for distilling, brewing, or winemaking. And he was the first brewer ever to win that award. Mm. And so I think that's a testament to, broadening these tropes of personas that historically people think that we do. But in actuality, like, we've always done a lot of different things. I mean, he's been brewing beer for 40 years. It's not a new thing. It may be new that someone knows he exists, but it doesn't make it new for him.
Right.
I do want to take it back just to step again with a question. You had mentioned that there's certain traumas that are kind of related to displacement in the community. We had a former guest speak about root shock and how individuals go back to the community, and it's just, it's a lot to deal with. What's your experience been with that?
Growing up, we always went to church in Northeast Portland, and so we were in Northeast Portland or visiting family, friends weekly. And then in college, I used to go get my hair. I had cornrows at the time, and I used to go get my hair braided on Deakum in the neighborhood that I live in now. And there was a drive-by shooting while I was in the shop, and they were trying to get somebody at the bus stop out in front of the shop, but nonetheless, the shop got shot up while I was in it. And I think as it relates to your question about root trauma, that happened in 98. We bought our house in 04. And in that 6-year period, I was shocked at how different the neighborhood was. I mean, there was a time where police were hesitant to go into Woodlawn Park at night. And now moving to a place and there's white folks with strollers, right? And like in the middle of the day. And so that's shocking. What I think is painful for me is when people say things like, well, now that I'm here, things are better. Or that they assume the people that lived there before didn't invest in their houses or didn't care about the community. Or they don't take time to know the history of a neighborhood, of who was there before them and the families that were there. And, you know, I think a common occurrence is, you know, hearing new neighbors talk about their garden in the back, and like that's a new thing. And it's like, all black folks had gardens in their yard back in the day. Like that's not new. And so I think that, and I heard some of it in the movie with Nikki, was people just, they didn't appreciate what was going on. And so it's always nice to meet a neighbor who goes and says, hey, we moved here because of the rich history of what was going on here. And this was the only place where our you know, son or daughter could go to a school that was more diverse. Mm-hmm. And they appreciated that. And they seeked that out while also understanding the privilege of, yeah, like, you know, my parents gave us $30,000 so we could do a down payment. And I know a lot of people, most people can't do that.
Yeah. How do you sift through like the bull crap? The difference between the Black Lives Matter sign or the individuals like, oh, I'm here for the diversity, but yeah, but you know.
But could you turn your music down? I'm going to call the police if you don't turn your music down. Let's put it this way.
Yeah. I deal with real folks. I mean, thankfully, I've got a Puerto Rican mom who, you know, makes sure that I always come with it. I tend not to tiptoe down around with folks. And I'll tell people, like, I'm looking for an accomplice. I'm looking for someone who's willing to lose something in order to support me. You know, I don't need an ally. You know, an ally dips in and dips out as they see fit, or when mm-hmm. it's cool, when it's convenient. But, you know, you give me an accomplice, someone who's willing to, you know, get in trouble or whatever when stuff goes down. And by and large, that's what I see in my neighborhood. You know, I'm lucky that, you know, our kids get to play with a bunch of other black kids that look like them in their neighborhood, you know, a block away. We can just open the door in the summer and the kids just go outside and do their thing. But when I do see the bull stuff, call it out, right? Because it doesn't have to become like DEFCON 1. You can just call it out when it's like DEFCON 5 or 6, where it's like, you know, you're not really saying anything when you say that. Like, or I tell people, this is how it made me feel, as opposed to you're racist, right? Because that's not a conversation to have with someone. Like, Cornelius, you're racist, right? No, I'm not. And then we're done. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, hey, last week on Tuesday when you were taking out your garbage and you did this, this is how it made me feel. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I just found out that morning that my mom passed away. And so I was in a really bad spot and blah, 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 blah. Cool. All right. Great. We talked about it. You know, we're living at a time in the United States where we spend the least amount of time with our neighbors than we ever had. And we live in the closest proximity as Americans than we've ever had in the United States.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about kind of the myth of the disappearing black Portlander. And
it's not a myth, though. They are disappearing from Northeast. right?
And right.
Voluntarily and not involuntarily, but that's still, for Nikki, that's not a myth.
Right.
That's a very real reality. And so I think all I'm saying is there's other perspectives as well. But I would never say that was a myth.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So then you've been involved with business, but you've also been involved with housing, with affordable housing.
Yeah.
And how have your views on affordable housing changed over the years? So we first started talking about this issue 5 years ago or so.
Yeah. So I chair the affordable housing bond for the city of Portland on behalf of the mayor. And I think before, change was slow, and things didn't seem, the gravity of things didn't seem so big. But as you really step into the arena that I'm in now, I see the gravity of what's going on. We have 125,000 households that are going to move here by 2035. We are on pace with the affordable housing bond money to create another almost 2,000 units. And between other investments, between now and 2035, we'll create another 5,000 in total affordable housing units. So 125,000 households, only 5,000 new affordable housing units. So it's a daunting thing. And then 2 years ago, it really hit home. There was a knock on our door, and our neighbor who lived in a house, who had lived in a house four houses down from us on the same street, had her 5-year-old son with her and a tent. And she wanted to know if she could rent space in our backyard and live in our backyard. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to respond. And she ended up staying with us and staying inside. And we gave one of our kids' bedrooms to her and her son. And they lived with us for 3 months. But it was appalling. I mean, here was someone who literally had 5,000 square foot lot without a single family house. Mm-hmm. And then a divorce. And she's out, you know, sometimes sleeping in her car. And so
was that kind of a wake up call? Because I almost felt like when we talked 5 years ago, you were a little bit more on the libertarian side of things. And maybe you had less focus.
Maybe it didn't seem as
on,
urgent,
yeah.
Right? Because I still, you know, one of my good friends who I call my second mom, she still does affordable housing on Alberta Street, where mm-hmm. someone could rent a 1-bedroom apartment for $600. And she does it. And she's got dozens of units that, you know, she keeps rented up. So I know scenarios like that still exist in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But to have your neighbor and a kid at your door where you got to make a decision, like, do I bring them into my own house? I mean, mm-hmm. it's all academic until it touches home, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, my wife and I made that decision, but that was real stuff. And mm-hmm. and sadly, at the same time, we had a single family house 2 doors down from us that was owned by a local affordable housing nonprofit that hadn't been lived in over a year. And this woman was
I know that building.
Camping, was camping.
It's PCRI.
Was, but you know it's urgent. We need all hands on deck. We need every idea. You know, everything should be on the table at this point in time.
Do you see more Stephen Greens coming to the fore, in at the neighborhood level of like sort of preservation, restoration, maintenance of communities like Albina? And you know, I'm angling towards people like Queen Latifah, Marshawn okay. Lynch, and Rick Ross, who were kind of like, we need to get in the game of real estate in the black neighborhoods.
I think the most important project in the foreseeable future is really the Albina Vision that covers the Albina area of where Morrill Coliseum, Portland Public Schools property, their headquarters is. That's being led up by Rakai Adams. That one mm-hmm. is a 40-50 year vision of billions of dollars being invested.
And do you see that? Like, so Rakai is an African American woman. She's from the neighborhood, Ivy League education, was development executive for Myo Memorial Trust, right?
She's the chief investment officer for Myo Memorial Trust.
Which is a huge charitable trust, the largest trust in Oregon. Yep. Right? So when she gets involved in the neighborhood, she doesn't have a sign on the street. She has dropped in this enormous macroeconomic play can move a mountain.
Yep.
So that's an example of like the middle class, like having their presence felt in a huge way. Do you see that happening around the country as well? Do you think we're seeing more like players like this coming back?
Yeah, but I think it takes everybody, right? So I don't think it's about the right middle class people coming in or the right rich folks coming in. You need to have people identify issues and problems and then figure out ways to plug other people in, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're building a team, you need a catcher. You need a center fielder. You can't just have a ton of second basemen. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we have right now is we've activated a broader audience of people into economic development than we've ever had before. And
maybe this is kind of just to tie it back. In terms of wealth creation and black businesses and entrepreneurial opportunities, gentrification, is it a positive factor in wealth creation in the black community? Historically, is it something that creates wealth and entrepreneurial opportunities for black communities when it happens, or is it a net loss?
It's both, right? So if we went to Atlanta right now, where they're experiencing gentrification as well, it's black people moving in and black people moving out. And so there's always going to be externalities, and some of those are going to be positive and some of those are going to be negative.
That's an economic term. Explain externalities.
So externalities are going to be we go and we do A, which leads to B, but the unforeseen externality is F, that we didn't know
negative consequence,
right? So you and I want to start this hair care business. We go into a space in Northeast Portland and it hasn't been there hasn't been an occupant in there recently. We sign a lease for 5 years and we invest in the space. Now the value of that property is increased. And now other property owners can go and say, oh, well, we were charging $500 for our apartment. But now that the beauty shop's there, we're gonna charge $750.
So it's right? Not necessarily a bad consequence. It's just a consequence that doesn't involve you as an investor.
Yes.
And that other people impacts, yeah, positive or negative.
Exactly. And it's not directly related to the action that we initiated ourselves.
So, but given the makeup of these neighborhoods around the country, and Atlanta's pretty exceptional.
Yeah. I would say, when you look nationally at, home ownership, less than 35% of black households own their home. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the number one way that you benefit when a property values are rising is owning the property where you reside. So that means if less than 35%, that means, almost 70% of the time we're a renter. That means we're going to be negatively impacted because, generally in a rising economy, the landlord's not going to go and say, hey, I'm going to decrease the rent $30. They're going to go and say, hey, I got other people that are willing to pay me more. So I'm going to increase it to you, or you can move out. Take your pick. But now I got this opportunity that didn't exist before.
And is there anything else that we can do on policy-wise or conversation about turning those investments in these neighborhoods into opportunities for wealth creation?
Yeah. So, one of the things I think about, especially from the public sector side, is how do we make investments using public dollars that support ends that the market's not going to provide for? Right. And so how can we go and say, hey, I see that black homeowners are declined for loans to buy homes at a higher rate than others. We're going to go and do this thing to kind of bridge that gap so that more black households can own their homes. But that's not something that the market's going to go and say, hey, let's go and fix this.
Right.
So how can you steer that? But at the end of the day, it becomes calling it out. Like, before the Portland Business Journal called out the business loan gap, no one was talking about that.
And what was that?
That the number of SBA loans dropped 96% between 2008 to 2018. Before that, people were silent, right? Mm-hmm. And so they did an article almost 2 years ago, and still not a lot of people are talking about it. But that's something that should cause pause for the power structures here at play. And maybe not solve it, but at least call it out. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I, I hope, you know, begins to happen more and more is people go and say, hey, man, I see these disparities happening. Let's have a conversation around what my role is in perpetuating these things, or how can I, you know, provide time, talent, or treasure towards closing those gaps. But being silent about it, that clearly doesn't help anyone.
How can we as Black Portlanders keep money in our pocket a little bit longer?
So you're talking about the trigger warning, yes. Killer Mike. You know, the thing that really stuck out to me in that documentary was, you know, he went to go and try and spend a whole week or a month just going to Black businesses.
It was he had 3 days to get from Athens, Georgia to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And within that 3 days, he had to only use a Black business. So transportation, food, everything. So he had to get rid of his car and just basically work off of cash.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as easy. He found himself with nowhere to sleep that night. There were no Black hotels for him to go to, or really was struggling with even finding Black-owned food.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so much he found Black businesses, but it was like, well, where are you getting your meat from?
Yes.
White farms. Where are you getting your vegetables? White farms.
Yep.
And so it still boiled down to the struggle of, okay, if we don't own the land, how are we going to, you know, how are we going to go all Black? So watching that, I felt like, okay, that's a bit extreme. You know, like as far as
it is, but it's a good exercise to illuminate the idea of, you know, there's a friend of mine will say there's two kind of folks in the world, those that sign the back of the check and those that sign the front of the check. Right. And the person that signs the front of the check is generally the person that owns things. Right. And then the person that signs the back is the employee or the person that does not own things. I did a Twitter post about this where I think Mike would have had an easier time in Portland with what he was doing.
Oh, really?
We actually have two marijuana growers that are Black. That was a important big piece of what he was trying to do. We have a couple Black-owned farms here in town that grow vegetables. You know, he could have went to the Black-owned coffee shop. Not aware of a grocery store. That would have been a tough one.
There's a lot of Ethiopian markets.
There is. That's true. That's true. Black Airbnb he could have used here. I know a couple folks that would have loved to have him stay. But it brings up a really good point about, you know, assets being such a key piece of our participation and benefit in the market as the market changes. And this relates definitively to priced out and what was going on with Nikki is, you know, she had the ability once she was an owner, once she had an asset, to benefit from the changes that were happening in the neighborhood. Quite often we're not the owner of assets, right? We earn an income, we earn a wage, but we don't actually own things that appreciate over time. And so how do we shift more and more of our resources and energy to being owners of assets that appreciate over time? Versus, you know, earning income and putting money into things that depreciate over time.
I was together this weekend. I got together with the group is 15, but about 10 of us showed up.
Yeah,
just 10 Black men. All of them are connected by something related to nerd culture.
Ooh.
So all these different men, all smart, got together, but it was just based off of this need and this desire to be together.
Yep.
When you get a group of Black men together or even Black women here in Portland, what are some of those conversations? What are some of the purposes of those meetings?
So the event that we do regularly that I put on, it's called The Gathering. And we generally have 30 to 60 Black men show up, and we do it at Oliver Twist, a local Black-owned business in the Pearl. And the really cool thing is to see the interactions of folks who I already see outside of the event and see their guard down, right? They're a different version of themselves in small ways than they are when they're at work at their, you know, high functioning professional job or whatever. And they can just let loose and instead of being the black guy in the room, they can just be Steven, right? Mm-hmm. And like, you know, Steven, the nerd who loves spreadsheets, right? As opposed to, you know, shouldering the burden of, well, Steven, what do black people think on this? Like,
yeah.
Ah, oh, man, I can't answer that.
But if you're
that
just going to talk about spreadsheets, Steven, we don't want you on the podcast.
Exactly. That doesn't fit what we were looking for. I want to hear your struggle. And so I think it's a safe place where folks know, like, yes, you know, maybe my 9-to-5 job, I'm the only or one of few, but I look forward to this break where I can just connect with brothers and we can have the understood nod of, yes, the shared experience in the city that we do love, but also understand the detractors that these kind of moments are few and far between. And so, you know, oftentimes I'm asked, oh, what's the programming? And I'm like, you're just there with other black men. Like, that's it. We come together and there's a special, you know, maybe it's something to do with pheromones or something, but just special things
we'll
happen when
out.
We come together. Yeah. And oftentimes there's so many of us that we have to spill out onto the side patio of the business, which is right on 11th Avenue in the Pearl. And there's nothing like a summer night where there's 50 black men outside of a business in the Pearl and just watching people walk by and just like bewildered. And just
so it's a very upscale, very white, it's a really sort nice, of very urban, high density neighborhood downtown.
Yep. And so we always have people that will stop by and be like, what's going on here? What is this? Tell me what, is this a convention? Or, and I was like, oh, we're just getting together, supporting a black business. And people always say, oh, well, which black business are you supporting? And I'm like, this one's a black-owned business. I'm like, oh, I had no idea that this was a black. It is the oldest black-owned business in the Pearl.
That brings up this question I do have for you. That myth that black people don't want to pay full price, that we want to hook up in some way, shape, form, or fashion. What's your experience
I laugh at that because there's in the Black Portland group on Facebook, whenever I talk about a black business, I'll do the hashtag pay full price.
Right.
Right. One of my best friends owns a coffee shop here downtown. I go there almost every day and I've never gotten a discount. He's got a coupon where if you buy 10, you get the 11th one free. I don't do that at all. And when I talk to folks about it, it's more of a myth than what I've seen.
Yeah.
But we always think about the things that support are the things in our mind, right? So if one person asks for the hookup, but the other 19 pay full price, and your idea is that people always want to hook up, you're going to over accentuate the person that asked for the hookup potentially. But I think when I hear it, what I more so dig into with founders is talking about you are worth what you ask people to pay you, whether they are black, white, old, young, male, female, LGBTQ, like whatever, like you need to set your worth. And if you're letting, you know, whatever group get away with not paying full price, you're discounting the value that you bring to the table. Don't do that to anybody, let alone, you know, black folks. And so, you know, I will post and talk about a black business and I'll say, go and support them. And when I say support them, that does not mean go and say hi and whatever. That means spend your money and pay full price and keep moving and tell your friends to do the same.
Do you have a message for anyone who's thinking of coming to Portland, especially African-Americans who are wanting to come this direction?
I would say, one, we're out here, right? And so we are not Chocolate City, but the nod is alive and well in Portland. When you walk down the street, you see someone of color, they will give you the nod 99% of the time. And if they don't, let me know. I will rebuke them appropriately. We have a shared experience here that when I meet people from other parts of the country, they oftentimes have such a negative perception of what they think they're going to encounter, that when I do, you know, help them see how you could have a very black experience here in Portland, they're delighted. And people love the weather here. They love the outdoors. It's on the west coast, so it's got a different vibe to it than the east coast. And so, you know, when I have people come out here, I always say we're out here, you know, regardless of what the Atlantic has said or other, you know, watching Portlandia, like
Kamal Bell,
we're you know, and Kamal knows that's my man. shout out Kamal Bell and being able to hang out with him here and show him the town. But, you know, regardless of our numbers, we've got people that'll dap you up. We got a ton of black businesses that you can come and support and feel at home at. Even though it's a different town than where they're coming from. And so the city's not for everybody. Right. So I don't believe there is this, you know, utopia, black city as of yet that I've found. But I do think Portland has a lot to offer for folks that are interested in coming out here. And I'm always more than happy to drop what I'm doing, like I did this weekend, to host somebody and show them around. So,
all right.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you for having me. Right. Yeah.
Well, that was Stephen Green.
Yeah, man, I'm excited about getting this one out there because he dropped a lot of really good nuggets throughout this episode.
Yeah, Stephen's such an insightful guy. I really enjoy talking to him, and whether it's on the podcast or in panel discussions, and I hope we can have him back because he's still got a lot more than he can say.
Oh yeah, it's one. It was so much, you know, material that we you know left on the cutting room floor. We could have almost done a second episode.
Totally. So, but we needed to make a little room to talk about Captain Marvel.
Yeah. Well, you know, so as we're recording this,
we
haven't seen it yet. But what we have seen is controversy. Just popping up everywhere where individuals are just saying like, hey, this, I've heard people say this movie isn't good. But then I've heard everyone really take the narrative way further than the movie and make this kind of a woman's empowerment issue or a feminist issue. So what have you heard?
Well, so I only listened to Comic Book Girl 19. And she basically said that at this point, Brie Larson, the star, had made some comment at a press junket like there's too many like white men reporters here at this. And that like launched a firestorm of controversy. She basically said she doesn't even know if that was a sincere comment or if that was just the studios encouraging some controversy because the movie is so boring and so bland. But I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think what I agree with Comic Book Girl 19 is that Captain Marvel has always been like kind of like a blah or a non-entity in the Marvel universe, and it's just no answer to Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was such a big deal.
Well, I think that's the problem, is that individuals see it as, is this a follow-up? Is this the female version of Black Panther? And it can be. And then to drop an origin story in the middle of everything that's going to like, okay, right now half of everyone's dead.
And, because of the Avengers.
And you're going to take us all the way back to the 1990s and try to make Samuel L. Jackson, who's 70, you know, apparently.
Digitally make him 45 or whatever.
And so it's sort of like, there's a lot with this movie that I feel people are going to go see it because they need to see the trailers at the end to see how it works into Endgame. Right. But people are just patiently waiting for Endgame. That's really all this is.
And it's just unfortunate that Marvel just doesn't have a super iconic solo female superhero. I mean,
solo.
Solo. They have lots of them that are in teams.
Yeah.
And they should really just make a solo movie. Like, this is Comic Book Girl 19, and I agree. He's like, take Rogue, who actually, the reason why Rogue is interesting is because she took Captain Marvel's powers. And let her have a solo movie, or let Storm have a solo movie.
Cut them free. And now once the universe is united, and they'll have all of the X-Men characters back from Fox.
Yeah, because they don't.
The Jean Grey character. There's a few different characters that I think, and like you said, Storm, taking control of that character could potentially be a really good thing in the future to create a character that people will be invested in across the board. So yeah.
Totally, and Storm could totally do huge damage, like just box office wise, because she's a totally fascinating character.
Yeah.
And she's like an African solo woman who's one of the most powerful characters in the whole universe there. And yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see. There's a lot. So maybe next time we get together, we'll have a deeper conversation, you know, about how you felt about the movie. And really, yeah, we can compare it a little bit to Wonder Woman. It might be an unfair comparison, but so let's do it.
We, as men, should really explain to the world how a female superhero movie should work.
I feel firm.
On firm ground there.
Yeah, let's not go down that road. Because people may not know if we're joking or not.
Right, so, no, they won't.
All right, well, we, like you said, we had a really great show with Stephen Green, and we got a lot of good things coming your way real soon. So we'll check you out next time on Priced Out the Podcast.